Police Academy is your source for the no apologies, no spin truth about all things police. Discussions about why cops do what they do, avoiding speeding tickets, or just how to stay alive can all be found right here. No questions out of bounds, no topic too sensitive. This is Police Academy. Do you understand
the words that are coming out of my mouth? What we're dealing with here, glittering air, is a complete lack of respect for the law.
And smoke in the reef.
Call the dust pop.
We live in a society of laws.
Dust pop?
Yeah.
No, it's not real.
This thing of weed.
Takes one shot a weekend of training to get that bag.
Welcome back. This is episode 5 of the Ferguson series, and yes, it is the last episode. Before we get started, today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/policeacademypodcast. I know that's a mouthful, which is why that link is in the show notes for this show. Just go there and click it, and you'll be hooked up with your free trial. Audible has over 180,000 titles to choose from, and you can listen on your iPhone, Kindle, Android, or other MP3 player. I love Audible for the same reasons I love podcasts. I can listen while I'm driving, mowing, cleaning the house, or any other task that would otherwise be mundane, and I actually retain the information better than when I read. I don't know if that's because I suck at reading or what, but I have found that to be true for myself. So check him out, audibletrial.com/policeacademypodcast. Our other sponsor is 5.11. 5.11 makes extremely high quality equipment and clothing for law enforcement and civilian personnel alike. Again, there is a link in the show notes to get to their site. And by clicking that, you are not only supporting Police Academy, but you're going to get hooked up with some awesome gear and clothing that will last forever. They are highly respected within law enforcement because they make good stuff. So check them out. Click the link in the show notes. Those are our sponsors for this show. So let's begin. We start with Dorian Johnson's story as promised, the media's key witness. And you can see why the media love this guy when you hear what he has to say. I must remind you that while I tell it as if it's fact, just like Dorian did, it is only a story. Dorian Johnson's morning started off like a regular summer day, playing video games and hanging out with his friend, Michael Brown. Things get weird, though, when Brown starts acting out of character, robbing a liquor store and assaulting the clerk before strolling down the middle of the street without a care in the world. Soon, Dorian's legitimate fears become reality, and the police show up. The officer, as described in earlier episodes, uses profane language and demands that they walk on the sidewalk. When Dorian tells the officer that they're, quote, not but 1 minute from their destination, end quote, the officer takes offense and forcefully opens his door, slamming it into Brown. This angers Brown, and a scuffle begins. Despite Dorian admitting that Officer Wilson would have to be superhuman to overpower Brown, Wilson is able to grab and hold on to Brown with just his left arm. As he tries to escape without entering the window of the SUV or hitting the officer, Brown is able to get, quote, the best of the officer, end quote, something he fails to mention in the following media interview.
He did not initially assault the officer. I didn't see at no point in time while I was standing in the officer's driver door window where he touched the officer in any type of threatening way, not whatsoever.
The tug of war continues until the officer draws his gun, points it out the window, and shoots Brown in the chest. Dorian takes off running with Brown right behind him. He ducks behind a car as Brown runs past and says, "Keep running, bro." From his crouched position, Dorian watches as the officer runs past him in pursuit of Brown. He fires a shot, hitting Brown in the back. Brown puts his hands up in surrender and turns around. "I don't have a gun." the officer continues to close the gap. Brown starts to repeat that he's unarmed when the officer, still moving forward, fires at least 4 shots and kills Brown. Despite his apparent front row seat to the event, Dorian's story changes each time he tells it, indicating that he's fabricating much of it. While he likely did see what happened initially, after the first shots were fired, he was much more concerned about himself than what was happening between Wilson and Michael Brown. Witnesses 123 and 133 were in a Monte Carlo right behind Officer Wilson's cruiser when this all went down. The following excerpt provides some insight into what Dorian, witness 101, was up to as the foot pursuit took place, and I'm quoting from the Department of Justice's report here. Quote, witness 123 ducked after the second shot, and therefore could not see if Brown was injured. Between 4 and 6 seconds later, he looked out the front windshield to see Wilson emerge from the SUV with his gun held low. At about the same time, witness 101 approached the Monte Carlo's passenger side door, which witness 123 had already opened to allow him more room to duck. Witness 101 asked if he could get into the car, but witness 123 would not permit him to do so, instead instructing him to duck down. Witness 123 then turned his attention to witness 133, who was shaking. While witness 123 attempted to calm witness 133, witness 101, Dorian, disappeared and they never saw him again. End quote. Other witnesses indicated Dorian fled the scene prior to the final shots being fired. In fact, he admits he left the scene to change his shirt so he wouldn't be recognized by the police. Remember, he's afraid of getting in trouble for the robbery that was just committed, and now all of a sudden his friend just attacked a police officer. By the time he talked to investigators, Dorian had already lied to the Brown family and national news media, further spreading this virus. I'll preface what I'm about to say by clarifying that I am not making excuses for Dorian. What he did was wrong and dangerous, lying to national news media about something this serious. But you have to realize that when something like this happens, it's not like watching it on YouTube. When a 40 caliber handgun goes off and you're within feet of the muzzle, on the receiving end, any normal human being's body goes into fight or flight mode. Dorian's obviously did that. He immediately took off and was frantically trying to get into the first car he found. Instead of just admitting that he didn't see everything and just giving the facts, the things that he actually did see, he fills in the blanks with assumptions and hearsay and rumors that he picked up from other people or that came from within his own mind. We don't know for sure. Now, it's impossible to know exactly why Dorian and the other inconsistent witnesses provided testimonies that weren't true. Assumptions, empathy, common sense, and other stated reasons give us some insight, but they don't get to the core of why this virus spread like it did. The Department of Justice also studied the Ferguson Police Department after this incident, and their findings shed more light on the Ferguson community's immune system and why it was so susceptible to this virus. In its 105-page report, the Department of Justice explains that the city of Ferguson, from town hall to the courthouse to the police department, had created an environment of distrust and resentment between the police and members of the community. They'd been doing the opposite of community policing, using police officers in the courts as a revenue system rather than a public service. The report also indicates that Black members of the city had been disproportionately affected by this focus on revenue policing, due in part to what the Department of Justice calls racial bias. This is certainly no excuse for the community's response to the Michael Brown shooting. Burning down innocent people's livelihoods and intentionally supporting a false, racially charged narrative was wrong. But if the city of Ferguson's practices created an environment in which this virus could spread like it did, finding a cure starts by talking about these very issues. The sad irony is due partly to the atmosphere created by the city of Ferguson and communities across the country like it. This virus is now an epidemic. I have seen firsthand the degradation of regular, law-abiding people's faith and trust in the police based on an overwhelmingly negative perception created by the media. Hopefully, as more people learn the truth, some of that trust can be restored. But trust is needed on both sides of this discussion. It is a two-way street, as we all know. Unfortunately, because of the response to Michael Brown's death, officers all around the country don't trust the system either, which has created the Ferguson effect. When I was still an officer, I never worried much about having to stand before a grand jury, having to take someone's life. I trusted my training, my instincts, and my principles. If I shot someone, it would be justified. At least that was the goal. Just like my approach with Police Academy, I trusted that the truth would always be my redemption. I trusted the system would work, that my department and my community would defend my actions, if they were just. Deep down, I knew things wouldn't be so clean and tidy, but it at least helped me sleep at night. I wasn't going to worry about something that I can't control. There's no sense in that. But since Ferguson, every officer in this country has, or at least should have, considered whether the rightness, the justness of his or her actions would be enough at the end of the day. They've had to ask themselves, no matter how justified, will I have my job, my home, my freedom, when the truth is made clear? Before Ferguson, even a realist like me could at least tell myself I would. But now it's obvious to all of us, officers around the country, that the truth isn't enough. Darren Wilson's actions on August 9th, 2014 were as justified as they come. Since that day, every officer in the country has seen what has happened to his life. He's been accused of being a racist murderer. He lost his career and lives in seclusion. He is no longer a free man. Despite the fact that the grand jury and Department of Justice vindicated his actions. And if it can happen to him, it can happen to anyone in uniform. Ever since Ferguson, there has long been talk about whether officers and departments have changed their ways in its wake. Are police officers backing off, choosing to ignore obvious crimes, to avoid the possibility of becoming the next Darren Wilson? Are departments creating policies to reduce risk rather than to protect the public? Is the Ferguson effect real? A recent investigative study conducted by Blake Consulting and Training indicates the Ferguson effect is very real and surprisingly pervasive. And if you want to read the article that they put out yourself, I have a link in the show notes to this episode, so feel free. In their study, which surveyed almost 500 police officers, we see that both officers and departments are shying away from proactive policing. 49% of the officers said they've cut traffic stops by 5 to 10 a month, and 47% said the same for pedestrian stops. Police officers are backing off, and this study gives some insight into why. A huge majority of these officers, 94%, think the media is, quote, somewhat or completely biased toward a negative representation of law enforcement, end quote. But hey, forget the media. Their departments have their back, right? Well, depending on which department they work for, I'd say these officers' responses would range from, I hope so, to hell no. 50% of them felt unsupported by their department's response, to current trends, and 74% said new training was no benefit at all. And I'll interject my personal experience here because I worked for a department that was generally very good, I think, at standing up for what their officers did on the street. If we did our jobs and we were doing it right, no matter how upset someone got about an incident, for the most part, our department stood by us. Even so, I always expected, or feared, I guess is the better word, that if something really went bad, despite my actions being correct, that my department might not be there for me in the aftermath. Now, no department spokesperson will admit to the public that their officers are doing this, backing off from doing their job. There are plenty of people who would raise hell if they knew their community's officers were putting their blinders on and avoiding enforcement action, but they are. NYPD, LAPD, Baltimore, Atlanta, Detroit, you name the city. I can personally guarantee there are hundreds of officers doing just this. Here is an excerpt from an LA police officer who writes under the name of Jack Dunphy. As we drive slowly along 83rd Street, we see gathered near the entrance to an alleyway just east of Avalon a few members of the local street gang, one of whom is perhaps responsible for killing Jermaine Murray. What do? We drive on. For we are not police officers in an ideal world. We are police officers in Los Angeles, in the year 2016. And we know there is little to be gained and much to be lost if we get out of our car and engage these young men. And if one of them runs, well, then we might have to chase him. And if we catch him, we might have to hit him, an incident that will be captured on cell phone video and posted on YouTube. And if the footage is sufficiently inflammatory, broadcast on local television news. And if one of these young men is armed and we have to shoot him, and if video of the shooting does not clearly demonstrate that we were fired upon first, we will see our chain of command abandon us and pronounce our tactics unsound. This despite the fact that few of our supervisors have actually stood in our shoes. And we might see that video become a national news story, one that will prompt the police commissioners, the mayor, the governor, and even the president of the United States to offer their unschooled opinions on the deficiencies of our actions. So, as we are not fools, we drive on. And if one of those young men should later fall at the hand of a gang rival, or if one of them should venture over to Main Street and shoot some other member of Jermaine's gang, well, then we'll go code 3 to the crime scene and ring the area with yellow tape and stand around while the homicide detectives sort things out. And we'll go home and tell our families and friends how sad it all is. But what can we do? I know some of you listening to my voice right now don't like what you just heard. If a police officer isn't going to do his or her job, they need to find a new one, right? Jack Dunphy can go be a trash man or a firefighter, for all you care. And part of me agrees, I have to admit. I despise the excuses often thrown up by the more veteran and jaded officers for their laziness and apathy toward the job. But this is different. The current environment is such that even if an officer does everything right, they could end up just like Darren Wilson or worse. Officers aren't shying away from the risks of the job. They're making a calculated decision to protect themselves and their families from a culture that doesn't understand what they do, a society who will crucify them based on little to no information at all. It's called the Ferguson effect, and yes, it's very real. I know. I left you guys hanging off a cliff again, and it is the end of the series. But I did that because most people in our society still don't know the truth about Ferguson. We are collectively still hanging off of this cliff. So at the end of this series, all I ask from each and every one of you is that you share it with at least one person. Put it on every social media platform that you have, tell your friends and family about it, and the next time someone mentions Michael Brown or Ferguson, ask them if they've heard this series, and if they haven't, help them find it. They may not even know what a podcast is, and if you get them started, they're much more likely to listen and find the truth. Now, that person you share it with might not be ready to go assassinate a police officer, but 20 people down the road, the story might very well reach someone in those shoes and either save an officer's life or their life. So realize the importance and the significance that you can have in this game. You literally could save another person's life. That's it. That's all I'm going to say at the end of this series, because that is the number one most important thing that you can do. I am simply the mediator here. You, ladies and gents, are the driving force for this series, for the podcast, for the truth. I cannot do it without you. Thank you guys. You rock. I will see you on the next one. As always, do good, be strong, fear nothing. This is Police Academy.